you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
I'm Austin Cross. Join me for LAist's new live event series with the James Beard Foundation. We Are Where We Eat will go behind the scenes of LA restaurants. The kickoff event is May 22nd. Tickets at LAist.com/events.
Hey there, How to LA listeners. We're back today with more author interviews from our day at the LA Times Festival of Books. First up, my conversation with Michael Arsenault. He's the New York Times best-selling author of I Can't Date Jesus and I Don't Want to Die Poor. His latest book is I Finally Bought Some Jordans.
I'm very much myself in every space that I'm in. I don't believe in that code-switching and diluting who you are. That's nonsense to me.
And later, I'll talk with Amy Price. She's a former general manager of the notorious Cecil Hotel in downtown LA.
People will say, oh my gosh, you worked there? What? You know, it means every time.
All that coming up after the break. Stick around.
Support for LAist comes from Latino Theater Company at the Los Angeles Theater Center, presenting the world premiere of Ghost Waltz by Oliver Mayer, a bold original recovery of Juventino Rosas, one of Mexico's most significant composers. Follow Rosas from his father's early death to his friendship with ragtime genius Scott Joplin, now on stage through June 2nd. Tickets and information at latinotheaterco.org.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
And we're back. I'm Ryan de los Santos, the host of How to LA. Right now, we're going to talk with Michael Arsenault. He's the New York Times bestselling author of I Can't Date Jesus, I Don't Want to Die Poor, and his latest book, I Finally Bought Some Jordans. Michael is originally from Houston, but now calls LA home. Hey, Michael.
Hey, y'all. Hey, Brian.
Just to start things off, in your own words, can you describe yourself and some of your work? And I'm really curious to know, from your perspective, what's your place in media?
That's an interesting question. What's your place in media? I'll start with, when I graduated from college, the economy imploded. So I had an idea of what I would be doing, but everything fell, kind of like now. But I started off on the internet. I was of the blog era, I guess you could say. Very active freelancer. I write a lot of political, cultural stuff. But I've always wanted to write books. My first book was called I Can't Date Jesus. I wrote about essentially, we're all taught to believe something about who we are. So I was trying to reconcile my religious background with being gay, having a really difficult childhood, finding peace with my mom, who was a very devout Catholic. So being a practicing gay was a challenge. And my place in media is a good question. I don't know. Media is like burning. So I'm working on a TV adaptation of one, particularly of my first book.
Okay,
let's hope that actually can happen. Well, you know what? I've been in development for like 6 years. So I'm in purgatory. So hopefully I get a little bit into heaven. I think my place just generally is, I think I will say, while there might be a lot of diversity, you know, in terms of presentation in media, I don't think there are a lot of working class, poor, black, Southern gay men like me with a voice. And so I think I do add something different in terms of both sexuality and particularly class. So I think that's my own little space. I would like to think my voice is very particular. So I still feel like in some ways I'm scratching and surviving. But at the same time, people have let me know with my third book, like my work is making an impact on people. I think losing my mom recently to cancer in a really short amount of time, and the TV strike and all those things all hit me at once. And I think for a second, a little bit longer than that, I kind of questioned my value. I know people say like your accomplishments, but that doesn't sometimes mean anything when stuff matters the most. So I really worried nothing I did mattered, but I'm snapping out of that. Well, I've snapped out of that, and people on my book tour have been really kind. So,
and you've kept it real in your writing.
I try to. I try to because I feel like I'd be a bad memorist if I didn't actually acknowledge how I feel. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I appreciate that.
I want to ask you, what piece of writing has impacted you the most?
Zora Neale Hurston, I guess, usually comes to mind only because her use of dialect, how she died, honestly, poor, and if not for Alice Walker digging up her grave, I don't know, that like haunts me in a bit. But I would just say her work, because I think when it was first introduced to me in like middle school and high school, I just really took to it. Yeah, other than that, maybe actually David Sedaris. I know that's random, but when I sold my first book, I was like, think of David Sedaris, but like if his dad had gold teeth. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think necessarily black people or anybody not white can talk about like darker elements in their life, but in like a comedic way. Mm-hmm. So I would say him. And actually an author named Helena Andrews, an LA native. She wrote a book called Bitches in New Black, which I truly know like opened the door for me to do my book. So yeah.
I love that. Talking about your writing, you write essays from experience, unearthing some hard processes, coming out, family history, relationship with mom and dad, cultural wars, racism, homophobia. It feels so real when you write about this, and particularly me reading it. When I was reading your writing, I was like, is it easy to share this? You know, is it hard? How do you feel about that?
None of it's been easy to share, but I was very intentional. I just feel like I really want to make people laugh and make people think. That's usually like the core of what I want to do with my books, but particularly with the third, and just generally speaking, I want people to feel less alone. And I really am about trying, because I call myself a recovering Catholic. So I think there's a lot of shame that we attach to things about ourselves that are not ideal, particularly in like America where money matters and status and all these things. So for me, it's just a kind of about helping people lose less shame about things. And if I can use my story to kind of personalize my political point of views or what I think, and I feel like I've done my part. But yeah.
When I was reading some of your chapters, I literally would laugh and then tear up at other moments, right? And I'm like, it felt like, damn, someone has gone through this feeling, or someone is writing about this feeling, or like, wow, you're making me feel seen in some sort of type of way. And I think that is a special thing from any media standpoint, whether it's visuals or writing or some other form. I'm sure you get this a lot from maybe specifically queer, you know, people of color.
I have. It's great. And actually, I've heard it from a lot of straight. I will say, you know, honestly, it was really hard to sell my first book because the idea was that being black and gay, and it's probably being country and not being like the right type, whichever that means is subjective, that my book had no real appeal or commercial viability. And I've always given like the audience more credit than people do, audience readers. Sorry, I'm jumping work, but
both.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote it for people like me, so I'm glad that those like have touched the most because that matters. But I've actually been surprised by the different types of people that have resonated with like one or more of my books, because I do think, you know, I don't sound corny like an after school special, but when it comes to like money, religion, those are really broad topics. I just think you don't usually get our point of view in that way, or at least like a strong point of view. So it's been nice to have people again remind me that like my words actually mean something to them, because grief sends your mind to like some really dark places. Yeah.
In your chapter, A Lovely View of a Burning World, you lay out the process of moving back to LA.
Yeah.
This is your second time living here?
Yeah, I lived in LA. The day Obama was inaugurated is when I lived in LA.
First time or second time?
The first. And the only reason I remember that specifically because an older black man at the airport was like, "You going to D.C.?" And I was like, "No, I'm going to LA." And he looked a little disappointed. Like,
yeah. You're in Houston.
I was in Houston. I left college. That was when everything imploded. And a friend of mine who actually went to SC pushed me to move out here and give myself like a shot. But I've actually had a longer history with LA. Magic Johnson used to have a scholarship called the Taylor Michaels Foundation. He would fly inner city kids from different cities. So I first came to LA like 2002. I didn't think I'd ever end up living here, but it kind of just has happened how it's supposed to. Yeah.
So you've been exposed to the glitz and glamour, but the realness of LA as well. In that chapter, A Lovely View of a Burning World, you talk about neighborhoods here, kind of comparing them or at least juxtapositioning them to Houston or New York.
Yeah.
I was reading your words and I was like laughing because you're like, these are my apartment needs. And it's like, da, 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 da. I'm like, damn, that's a list. But that is like part of the journey of a transplant. Tell me more about that journey.
It might have seemed like a long list, but I definitely went through it in New York. So, no, I came here like, no, I've worked really hard. I need to live a little bit better, finally. Yeah. So, I don't believe in this idea that, like, that was a big kind of debate in New York sometimes, like the idea of, like, a black gentrifier. And I can understand to an extent there are some like that. But for me, it was like there are only certain neighborhoods I would think to live in. And L.A. is a uniquely different place in that. This is actually the only city where... Well, I would normally want to live by people who were, like, black or, like, I'm used to living around blacks or, Latinos. And L.A. is different is that I feel like if you're not really from here, you got to learn L.A. a lot more. Otherwise, people know you're not here and you might get set up. So I clocked that really early when I was first here. So I was like, no. But I don't know. L.A. is a weird place to live as a transient. I try to be respectful of the fact that, like, I'm not from here. But honestly, when I came back, I was walking down the street smoking a Pure Beauty pre-roll, and I did not have enough time to really look. So I'm like, oh, I know Koreatown. This building wasn't here before. Let me look at it. How much is the rent? I'm like, oh, it's not that much difference from, like, the little bitty studio I lived in Harlem. But this is nicer. I'll live here.
But you also make it a point to say, like, you don't live in a black and brown community. You live in Koreatown, which essentially is, you know, it's Asian, but also a lot of Latinos. Tell me about that dynamic.
Yeah, if I could be straight up, like, I would love to live usually by black people, like I said, I'm usually used to being by blacks or Latinos, but the thing about LA, to me, if you're not from here, I'm not going to the neighborhood. They know I'm not from there. I don't want to get set up. No shade. Do you get what I mean? Does that, like, I don't know if most people really say that.
I know
that,
what you're saying, yeah.
But I think that is it's a difference in LA very specifically. LA is a uniquely, it's beautiful. It is a lovely view of a burning world, but when you move here and you don't know the area, it is an adjustment. And some people are like, oh, you should come live by West Adams, which is normally just Adams to people who are from here. But when I asked people from LA, they were like, you're not going there right now. Wait till you, once I get to know LA a little bit better, acclimate myself, I know what streets to hit. This might be my own kind of sensibilities, but I would advise the same thing to people who go to Houston and like, oh, I'm going to live in Third Ward because you heard in a Beyonce song. I'm like, that's cute.
Pretty hurts.
Yeah, I'm like, but what part of Troy you finna move to? I'm like, it's not all that nice. They might get you. I'm still actually navigating that because I am so used to being by black and brown people.
Yeah.
Houston is a very diverse space. Like, everywhere I've lived is diverse, but there's something very specific about the way the segregation in LA.
Yeah.
It's a lot louder. So I just think generally for me, it was more about, I used to live in Koreatown when I first lived here. It was some SC students. And then although it was Koreatown, that was more like Latinos in the hood, but it was just familiarity, to be honest. I still go by familiar. It's a weird kind of space. I'll see where I move after that. I don't know.
Well, I do live in West Adams, as you talked about earlier, so just
but
FYI.
But you're from here, though.
Yeah.
You know LA.
Yeah.
So even if it's something like new and sparkly, you know the streets. I don't know.
Reading that specific chapter as well, you write about what LA offers, you know, the culture, the hikes, being slower than New York City. Can you explain how LA might bring you the sense of being this badder bitch, as you note in the chapter?
Oh, yeah, I gotta speak up firmly. You're right, badder bitch. I'm actually wrestling with how slow, much slower I want to be, but I think LA is really good for me now. I really do believe it's like a lovely view of a burning world. I think things are a lot harder than mostly discussed, I think, on like a serious level, particularly in media. Like, even with the campaign, it's about how whatever Joe Biden has done for the economy, but I'm like, yeah, people are broke still, and half of the country can't afford rent, and that is so explicit here. This is the only place on earth, as much as I like LA, where I've ever lived, where people can literally step over those who don't have a home, and it's a level of dehumanization that I'll never, hopefully never adjust to or be numb to. That darkness aside, I just think for me, there's something to be said of, like, initially one of my friends who ended up moving here, he was like, LA's too bright. But for me, I think I needed more of the sun. I didn't want to be freezing. I don't think New York can handle water, and they're like one tropical storm away from, I don't know. I didn't know LA was going to have a monsoon season now, so that's an adjustment.
I mean,
yeah, I don't know. I need a prorated rent, but I don't know. And honestly, now even grieving, just being able to go outside being able to like drive around. And honestly, California is a really beautiful state. I think it's more like a stuck-up version of Texas. But that aside,
I mean,
politically, because I don't buy that liberal stuff. I'm like, y'all step over people on the street. It's not that liberal. But I don't know. There's something really beautiful and weird and special about LA. And I think for some of us who are, as I'm learning, like I'm a different person now that my mom has died, and I don't completely know who that is. And I've always had a strong sense of self. I think being able to like go outside, walk around, see the beauty of the place while in pursuit of things is just really helpful for me, and I made the right choice. One of the things I really kind of hate is that my family was actually, we wanted to create new traditions, so they were actually going to come here for Christmas and get to experience this. I really wanted to show my mom LA. It was just something about being able to walk around, show flowers, and she was gardening, and like she really liked that. I hate that I don't get to show her that now, even though I know she's with me. So yeah, I think LA is just, I don't know, it's keeping a lot of my dreams alive in ways I didn't think, if that makes sense. Yeah, I just hope I'm not an annoying transplant when I talk like this, but yeah, I think there's something still really special about the place. It is a little bit slower, and it does require an adjustment, but LA is a weird in a good way, and I think for me, that's where this is where I should be right now.
Yeah. I felt what you went through with the loss of your mom and the way you describe it in your book. Someone who has dealt with grief, or someone who has dealt maybe with the loss of something, a marriage, a friendship, not maybe the same thing as grief, but like a loss.
Yeah.
What would you kind of advise them? How would you advise them?
I mean, I'm only like 5.5 months into the worst pain I've ever felt in my life. And but I will say, well, you know what? I lost a friend to brain cancer that I mentioned in the book. And then I mentioned losing a friend to suicide before in New York. I think for anyone dealing with loss, I mean, it's nothing new, but I think everyone deals with grief differently. But I will say, some people don't acknowledge the loss. Some people avoid it. People suppress it. I grew up having to suppress a lot of things that was happening in my house and what was going on. Ignoring a pain won't make it go away. So if there's any advice that I could say is that everybody tackles loss differently. But if you're dealing with grief, you have to acknowledge it and you have to work on it every day, however is best for you. But I will say, because I've been hearing this, I don't know, it don't sound like, it's weird. People are like, you're so brave for admitting how sad you are. I'm like, I'm just being honest, so you don't need to give me a medal for that. But I also think sometimes, because we've lost so much with the pandemic, like 1 million people died and it really wasn't acknowledged. And there's a lot of, untreated hurt. I feel like you can see it, and when you deal with people, there's a lot of misplaced anger. I think that needs to be addressed. So if you're carrying loss, if you're dealing with something, you at least need to acknowledge it and try to figure out on your own way how to do it every day. Because for me, my friend in my building said, it's a hole in your heart that'll never go away. And I was like, damn. Mm-hmm. But when she said it, I was like, you're right. Mm-hmm. So for me, I know this, the void will never go away. It's never going to go away. But every day, I just have to try to find a little bit of joy and peace. Be honest, I cried all the way over here. I was in the middle of like bopping the future, dancing on Drake's grave like the rest of the people. and then I just had a moment where it hit me. But I didn't, sometimes you can sink in it, but sometimes you just have to push. And I kind of had that moment, acknowledged it, and just kind of kept going. You just have to acknowledge it, because it's not going to go away.
One of the lines I appreciate from your book, I'm paraphrasing here, you basically say, we don't talk enough about how hard life is.
Yes.
You know, and that just impacted me. I'm just like, we don't, you know. I may do that with my friends, but we don't talk it as a society, really, at least here in the United States. And I want to kind of segue into something you've brought up joy, you've brought up hardship, you've brought up grief. I want to talk more about who you are, you know, your intersectionalities that are apparent in your book, but I'm sure you have a lot more. Being Black, being gay, being Southern, from Houston, Texas. Shout out to Houston. I love Houston, Texas, by the way.
H-Town.
They've come alive in all chapters. What do you hope someone with similar identities might walk away after reading your impacting work?
Somebody from high school wrote me a really long message about how her son found out that I was from Horn Park in Houston, and I went to Madison. Like, the school itself has been rebuilt, but if you saw the old Madison, it literally looked like a prison. We were treated like prisoners. And she said, when he found out you were from Horn Park and you went to the old Madison, he thought for the first time in his life, I can be a professional writer. I don't have to be a certain type of black person, born of money, privilege, connections, whatever. I don't have to talk or be a certain way. I can be myself because I'm very much myself in every space that I'm in. I don't believe in that code switching and diluting who you are. I don't, all that, that's nonsense to me. But when she wrote that, it was really sweet. I was like, that's, I feel like I speak for a lot of people who are otherwise not in the conversation, at least in like these bigger spaces. And so for someone to say that, like, meant the world. Because I'm just, and that when everyone just says, your writing and your voice are so Houston, that's the best thing you ever tell me. I really do love home. And one thing my mom told me that I mentioned in the book was like, I know you love home so much, but it's hard for you to come back because there's a lot of pain here. And there is, but, you know, talking about my mom, choking up a little bit. But I think just generally speaking to what your point, I just think some of us can't, we can't help what we're born into. And life doesn't necessarily give us the opportunities to kind of escape our conditions. And if you are so fortunate to even be able to crawl out of these spaces that people otherwise would have kept you out of and provide hope, I just feel like that's the way it should be. I feel like, I don't know if that completely makes sense, but I just think for me, I'm myself and I know how lucky I am to be doing this. And I try to like live in gratitude and to, yeah. Hope I answered that, but yeah, I'm trying to stop myself from breaking down on the interview.
You take a moment if you need it. It's totally
okay. I can hear my mama saying, shut up, boy. Yes.
Where do you go to write or get inspiration here in the city?
I actually need your help with that.
Okay.
Because I haven't, like, I did that, I was better about that in New York. There were like little spots I could go to. But I don't know here, honestly. And I'm actually actively working on that because writing from my apartment all the time is not it. Okay. So you might have, you're gonna have to help me with that. I'm actively looking for places to go write.
And I think we might get the audience feedback. If y'all have spots for Michael to go write and chill and just ponder, drop us an email at howtolascpr.org and I will send it to Michael myself and take him there, you know?
Yes.
Maybe that's an episode.
Yes.
Michael, thank you so much for your time and sharing a little bit more about your writing and really who you are in LA now.
Thank you. This was a pleasure. I'm really glad we got to talk.
That was author Michael Arsenault. Check out his latest book, I Finally Bought Some Jordans. We'll have a link in our show notes. And finally, here is my chat with Amy Price. She was the general manager of the Cecil Hotel in downtown LA for 10 years. It's infamous for being the one-time home of serial killers like Richard Ramirez, also known as the Night Stalker, and for the mysterious 2013 death of Elisa Lam, a Canadian tourist who stayed at the Cecil Hotel. She was missing for weeks before her body was found in the hotel's rooftop water tank. Lam's death was ultimately ruled an accidental drowning, and officials said she had bipolar disorder, but didn't spell out how that may have contributed to her drowning. And there are still lots of conspiracy theories about Lam's death. Here's my chat with Amy about her book, Behind the Door, The Dark Truths and Untold Stories of the Cecil Hotel.
Amy, thanks for hanging out with me today.
Well, hello, you're welcome.
You know, there's such fascination with the Cecil Hotel here in LA and beyond, obviously. I want to ask you first, what kind of reactions do you hear from people when they hear that you were the general manager there from 2007 to 2017?
Usually it takes a minute. You know, when people, I talk about my previous job experience, you know, I managed a hotel for 10 years, you know, and people just assume it was something traditional, you know, like a Marriott or something like
right.
that. And so if they don't know where it was, then I'll, you know, I'll get a little clearer and say, I actually worked at this hotel in Cecil, it's located downtown Los Angeles. Does have a dark history, and people will say, oh my gosh, you worked there? What? You know, it means every time. I don't think any time I've ever answered that and it clicks, people are like, oh wow, cool. You know, they're just so shocked. You know, and the next question is like, how could you work there?
Oh, of course. What do you tell them?
Well, I think for the most part, people's perception of the hotel is just so based on the darkness of it, you know, where there was a huge element of running the place, you know, and that's exactly what I was doing. My responsibilities were huge. So I really enjoyed my job. I mean, there were some things that weren't, you know, that weren't great, and there were some really hard times, but I enjoyed where I worked, and I worked there for 10 years.
And you write that more than 80 people died during your 10 years working there. That's a lot.
I know. That's a lot. And I thought deeply about that number because I know it's a large number. And I do talk about my friend Pedro in the book a lot. And I asked him, you know, how many people he felt had passed away during his tenure. And he's hitting almost 40 years over there. Wow. Yeah, and he said it was well over 500 at that time. And that was, you know, many, many years ago. So that's how I feel that the number is, you know, pretty accurate. But another thing to note about that number is they're not murders. You know, I mean, these are people that, you know, passed away naturally, went to hospitals, never came back. And of course, you know, other darker things.
Yeah, other situations, which leads me to the question about the Netflix docuseries, you know, the crime scene at Vanishing at the Cecil Hotel. You know, this is the story of Elisa Lam that died there in 2013. What was it like to revisit that time for the documentary and talk about it?
I want to give you two answers on that. Initially, when I agreed to do the documentary, I really felt that I was going to be able to clarify for a lot of people of what had occurred. That truly was my intention, just because, you know, all the years and all the press, nobody was ever quoted from the hotel, or we never said anything, you know? So when the opportunity came up, I thought it would help the people that were so stuck with what happened to her.
And you couldn't say anything because you were on staff, so I'm assuming maybe upper management was like, no.
Legal reasons, you know, I never spoke to the press about anything. It's not just Elisa Lam, you know, but we certainly didn't say anything then either. So I was no longer working at the hotel when I decided to do the documentary, and I went for it to clarify.
Yeah. One more thing about, you know, Elisa Lam. You know, you heard so many thoughts and theories about the case, but you were there at the time. What do you know that happened, and what questions do you still might have lingering?
I don't have any questions that are lingering. I really don't. I mean, for me, I just want to say that mental illness is a real thing, and it's something that I think that we really need to start dealing with. You know, we see it all over the city.
Do you feel like there was a little bit of closure with that chapter in your life? That's 2017, you walked away from there a while ago.
No, not necessarily, but it's probably not the closure you're thinking of. You know, when I went there to talk about it, it was, again, I thought to clarify, but it was just such a sad thing, you know, just what occurred there. I mean, it will never just, like, leave my mind. I mean, it was a lot to go through just working there, you know, aside from, you know, what the world was seeing. You know, what we were dealing with head on was extremely difficult.
Can I also add that, like, as a general manager, you're not only taking care of the hotel, but also your employees and the people who are experiencing some traumatic scenes, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And then that's another part where, you know, I truly enjoyed my job because of the people that worked there. They were lovely. You know, they worked so hard and they were so committed. They worked there for many, many years. There wasn't a lot of turnover. So, you know, when all that happened, you know, and it was sad for all of us for, you know, a lot of different reasons.
How are you feeling now?
Post-Cecil or?
Post-Cecil, yeah.
I'm feeling good these days. Yeah, I'm working for myself. I'm doing interior design work and jewelry design, which, you know, I've been doing for many, many years. And just being myself.
I read that your interest in writing a book actually started pretty early in your time at the hotel. How and why?
It was right away when I first started working there, just the unusual things that occurred, you know, and it started with, I can't forget this. You know, the things that were happening were just like, wow, that's different, you know. So I started just to create a list of some of these highlights of things that I didn't want to be forgotten. But as the years went on and the more experience I got, I mean, I knew that I'd write a book. Yeah.
This is such an LA story as well. I feel like people may have seen the documentary, but it's also like I've been to the lobby of the hotel. I've, you know, have told people, oh yeah, it's around the corner from the Cecil Hotel. So it's an icon sort of in LA. Let's talk about the LA portion of that. You know, I'm assuming you get different reactions from people who have been longtime Angelenos to people who are from other places of the world. What are the local reactions?
Just a couple of different reactions just in general. Like, you know, one is, you know, just how awful, you know, the circumstance was when I'm talking specifically about Elisa Lam and how hard it must have been, you know, to manage it all, you know, it wasn't easy. But then there's the other, a whole other side where the conspiracy people, you know, feel that there's another story to be told. And to me, I feel like the Netflix documentary created a whole new chapter for that.
Yeah. This is a book festival. So what I'm asking folks is a little bit on their bookworm side. Where were you when you wanted to write something deep or something like, oh, I really got to get this out? Was it a coffee shop around here in LA? What was the place that like motivate you to keep writing and unblock writer's block?
Well, I really didn't struggle too much with the writer's block, but it was the commitment to write. So the Hollywood Reservoir, I mean, I would walk that almost every day and listen to songs that reminded me of that time period when I was working at the Cecil, and, you know, and just walk around for an hour and then reset. And that it's just such a peaceful place, and it's so close.
You also said that writing the book kind of served you as a form of healing. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, I knew I'd write a book, and a lot of the things that I was writing about were difficult to experience. So, you know, there are emotions that come up when you're writing about things that are unpleasant, you know, and in my book, I felt it was important to include, you know, parts of my personal pieces, you know, where how I got to the Cecil, what happened, you know, where I started from. So, I mean, that part was painful, but I think, you know, dealing with it and actually seeing it on paper, I learned a lot about myself, and, you know, and I think there's been a lot of healing since.
Yeah.
You know, and again, it's just kind of like let the cat out of the bag, you know, just include it.
Amy, thank you so much for coming by our booth and hanging out with me for a little bit.
Thank you.
That was Amy Price, author of Behind the Door, The Dark Truths and Untold Stories of the Cecil Hotel. Thanks so much to Los Angeles Times Festival of Books and to the LAist marketing team, including Patricia Tumong. Thanks so much to you for listening and catching this episode of How to LA. Again, don't forget to subscribe so you can catch up with every episode. Alrighty, y'all, that's it for today. This episode was produced by Monica Bushman. Our social media producer today was Alejandra Cid. Our How to LA team also includes Erica Washington, Megan Botel, Victoria Alejandro, and Evan Jacoby. Our executive producer is Megan Larson. And I'm your host, Brian De Los Santos.
Support for this podcast is made possible by Gordon and Donna Crawford, who believe that quality journalism makes Los Angeles a better place to live.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.